Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is episode number 67 with my guest, Bill Kahn, member of the Nexus Percussion Group based in Canada. Bill lives in New York State, but has been a member of Nexus since its inception almost 40 years ago, probably more than that. Well, I'm terrible with dates. But before we get to Bill, this podcast, well, first, this music you're listening to is a bit of traditional Zimbabwean Mbira music arranged by the Nexus Percussion Group. It's just titled Mbira. Very simple piece, but I don't know. I always find it quite striking. This podcast is brought to you by Small World Coffee, based in Princeton, New Jersey. There's two locations, one on Witherspoon Street and one on Nassau Street. Walk in, everybody's nice. The coffee's amazing. Pastries are good. And the folks seem loyal there. You don't live in Princeton? That's all right. Go to smallworldcoffee.com. And you can buy all the coffee you want. They'll ship it right to you. You don't even have to go to your house. So don't. Stay inside. Listen to podcasts. If it's raining, let the weatherman bring you your... Or not the weatherman. Let the mailman bring you your coffee. Straight from smallworldcoffee.com. They're also on Twitter, Twitter and Facebook. Also, Kyle Dunleavy makes amazing steel pans. Kyle studied with Dr. Ellie Minette, various workshops. He's performed with Trinidadian steel bands, including Phase 2 Pan Groove, Cypria Deltones, Southern Marine Steel Band. He's tuned for big bands in Brooklyn, such as the Crossfire Steel Orchestra, Kasem Steel Orchestra this past summer. He builds and tunes all of the steel drums for NYU, our steel band there. And he builds the personal low-G oversized lead pan played by Victor Provost. He also has built and tuned all of the steel drums I perform on in So Percussion, including my low E double seconds. And my new low C double seconds. Sorry, I was a little mesmerized there. I'm not sorry. This is beautiful. Anyway, Kyle Dunleavy. He's an amazing tuner, amazing guy. Look him up. DunleavyPans.com. DunleavyPans.com. Do you need steel drums for your middle school, for your high school, for your college, for your own personal playing? Drop him a line. He'll hook you up. Nice guy. Amazing drums. And finally, Liquid Drum. Todd Meehan. Or Meehan, as some are known to call him. Based in Waco, Texas. He has a company there that is all about percussion and community, and specifically tambourine, triangle, and castanets. So if you've got a problem with one of those incredibly niche instruments, look him up. LiquidRum.com or LiquidDrum.com. If you like to laugh, go there. He'll tickle every one of your funny bones. He's a hilarious dude. He's one of my favorite guys on the planet. And he's someone you can learn from. See how quickly I go from being silly to serious? All right, check him out, liquiddrum.com. All right, my guest today is a person that I'm always grateful to get to talk to on SOA and Nexus gigs. He's one of the founding members of Nexus, and is always the quiet one at the shows. He just very quietly observes. Bill Kahn is a very smart guy. He's a passionate guy. And he's wise. And I really enjoyed talking to him today. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Kahn.
I really appreciate you taking the time. We're rolling, by the way. And just a little, the way I like to do these podcasts is not with any particular structure in mind. I don't have an agenda as far as what we talk about. Just kind of want folks to get to know you a little bit. At least, you know, they're not going to know you as well as I know you. And I don't actually know you all that well, other than the handful of times that So has done stuff with Nexus, in the past. But this last time we were up at Drum Boogie up in Woodstock, and got to hang with you and Bob a bit, talking about just some general stuff around George Hamilton's music. And given that you've been in Nexus since the beginning, is that correct?
Yeah, and in fact, I was in Nexus even before Nexus was formed. So Bob and I had a little duo that we called Nexus when we were right out of college. I mean, literally the summer following our graduation, Bob was heading off to Washington to join the military Marine band. Mm-hmm. And we were, as soon as he got out of the Marine band, he came back to Rochester and we formed Nexus. Uh-huh. And it was inspired by Harry Partridge's music, which we were just getting into. It was inspired by various kinds of world music that John Wyer was getting into. We both made a trip to see John in Toronto, and John was already exploring world music there and improvisation big time. Mm-hmm. And we both knew John from playing with him in Marlboro a couple of summers ago to play Lenos there. So the soup had all the ingredients and yeah. It hadn't cooked yet.
Yeah. Well, before we get into like the moment when the ingredients were put into the soup, so to speak, can you just tell me? I'm gonna ask you maybe some questions that people may assume that I already know, so it may seem silly, but I'm gonna play dumb so that other folks get to know you a little bit better. Can you just tell me a little bit about where you're from? What got you into music? What was it like growing up as a kid? And sort of what were the sort of butterfly effect folks in your life that bumped you along the way to get you to where you're to what you're doing now?
Okay, I came from a lower middle class, upper lower class, right on the tweak line there, mm-hmm. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and went to Philadelphia schools. And fortunately, at that time, there was a very highly developed public school music program, which every student in the Philadelphia public schools participated in. There were classroom bands, percussion bands, to play music to accompany radio broadcasts. So once or twice a week, we would sit in front of the radio and sing along or play along. This is like third grade. Then in third grade, they also made available music lessons on orchestral instruments. I wanted to be a trumpeter. Turned out they had too many trumpets, so I got stuck on bass drum. That's a familiar story. So in the third grade orchestra, we had an orchestra, a string orchestra in third grade. I got to play bass drum. The first song I ever played on bass drum was called Firelight Shadows. And I was instructed to play. Here's my first lesson. My friend Barry, who was also at the same school and was already in the third grade orchestra, said, "Very easy. Just go boom, and I'll go tap, 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 boom, tap, tap, tap on the snare drum." So yeah. I did my boom. He did tap, tap, tap. Of course, we were in 3/4 time. 3/4 time. So right from the get-go, I was playing the wrong thing.
No, did you say, like, "Excuse me, teacher, it just goes over the bar. It comes out of the wash every 3 bars. Trust me."
Right. I mean, going before I knew what I was doing. So anyway, that was the first experience. Anyway, there was a very highly developed music education program. I got music lessons. I got drum lessons from a trombonist, but we were learning to read music, and it was all perfectly valid. played in the school orchestra, and it wasn't until I got into junior high school, although we had guest ensembles coming into school all the time. Mm-hmm. I got into junior high school, I got free tickets to Philadelphia Orchestra concert, and that like started a bonfire inside. I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
If I couldn't play baseball, I was going to play in an orchestra. So then I got into the All Philadelphia. I kept practicing, got into the All Philadelphia Junior High Band, where I met Bill Hinger. And he was mm-hmm. the son of the timpanist in the Philadelphia Orchestra, Dan Hinger. Mm-hmm. And Dan Hinger volunteered to coach us one lesson. I was involved with a section in that coaching session that was in a private, small, enclosed room where I fainted during the session because I didn't have breakfast that morning or something. No. Anyway, Hinger felt so guilty that he said, listen, if you like, anytime you want, just call me and I'll give you a free lesson. So we called him a week later and went to his house. I had a lesson with the timpanist in the Philadelphia Orchestra for free. And he said, well, you know, that's pretty good. Why don't you come back next week?
You were how old?
That went on,
remind me,
4 years. And then I had lessons at the Green Room down at the Academy of Music before Philadelphia Orchestra concerts. We got tickets to go to Philadelphia Orchestra concerts free in high school. A lot of the students in the Philadelphia schools got these kinds of tickets. Mm-hmm. So I find myself every Friday leaving school around 1 o'clock, skipping a couple of classes, with the teacher's permission, going to the Academy of Music to hear a Philadelphia Orchestra concert. I heard Stravinsky conduct, I heard Charles Munch conduct, and of course Ormandy, and a lot of great conductors. And this is the last 2 years of my high school. Mm-hmm. Then got into the Eastman School. So I really wanted to be an orchestra player. Where at the Eastman School, met John Weyer, met Bob Becker, met Robin Engelman, ultimately, who was principal in the Rochester Philharmonic. Fortunately, when I was a sophomore in college, in other words, my second year, there was no class ahead of us. All of the percussionists in the class ahead of ours, which would have been the junior class, they all left and good to go to other places. Mm. So I was a sophomore and a senior virtually for 2 years each, because all of the opportunities came our way,
yeah,
including my wife, Ruth, who was also in my class. So we got to play, even as a sophomore, we were playing with the Rochester Philharmonic all the time because they only had one regular percussionist. Mm-hmm. Graduated, and there was, at the time I graduated, the regular percussionist, Robin Engelman, who became later a part of Nexus, moved to Toronto where John Weyer was the timpanist. So they reconnected from a previous life in Milwaukee, playing in the orchestra together there. Mm-hmm. There was a vacancy in Rochester. Right out of college, my wife and I auditioned. I won the audition, although she played great. I heard her audition. She could have won. I don't know why, what the judges were listening for. But then there was an opening for first extra player, so Ruth was hired for that. Mm-hmm. So the two of us then became the percussion section of the Rochester Philharmonic for 30 years. Mm. So very lucky, just lucky breaks and things happening at the right time in the right place. Over which I had no control. Mm-hmm. The only thing I had control over was my practicing, and that helped. But I don't think that was the only factor. There was a lot of luck involved in this. So then as I was saying about John Weyer in Toronto, when I was a senior at Eastman, I was invited to go on tour with the Toronto Symphony. Seiji Ozawa was the music director there, and they needed an extra percussionist for their program, was included. Capriccio Espanol by Tchaikovsky, big percussion section. Mm-hmm. Capriccio Espanol by Rimsky-Korsakov. It was Capriccio Italien, Tchaikovsky. Capriccio Espanol, Rimsky-Korsakov. So anyway, big percussion sections. Mm-hmm. And so they needed me, and I was on that tour. Got to meet Seiji Ozawa and got to know him before he became a big star. And got to know John Weyer, who was just getting into world music. And, of course, on our free nights, we just listened to music and John was collecting bells and gongs and improvising with them, and we got to do some of that. So those were the basic starting points of Nexus, which was just a fascination with the new access to world music because of hi-fi recordings and because of instruments becoming a widely available, I should say generally available, not widely yet. You couldn't buy any of this stuff at Steve Weiss yet.
Right. Well, where were you getting it? Was it because musicians were traveling here, or you were traveling, you know, somebody would go to Ghana and pick up, you know, a Gilles or something, like, or an Amira? Like, how did that work?
traveled, but musicians were traveling here. We heard Indonesian musicians, we heard Indian musicians, we heard African musicians right here in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. They were traveling here. And the reason for that was jet travel, which was new. In the late 1960s, the tour I took with the Toronto Symphony when my senior year was all on a DC-8, I think, two props. Mm. You know, so the jet travel was not that widely practiced yet or known in commercial yet. Mm-hmm. So as it became commercially viable, then musicians could travel much more easily, have breakfast in one place of the world and then have dinner in another part of the world, which was not really possible before that.
Yeah.
So these musicians from other cultures were being touring North America and Canada. And then we got exposed to that and became interested in the music. And of course, the music of other cultures is percussion heavy. Mm-hmm. And that was fascinating to us who had been through college and had never heard any of this music and had no idea what was going on elsewhere. So this opened our minds and started explorations that led to Nexus.
Well, before we get into Nexus, the one thing that struck me is the common thread amongst, and correct me if I'm wrong here, almost all of you, with the exception of maybe Bob, is orchestra playing. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And
that was that was our life.
And I would say in terms of I know that the four of us and so talk a lot about the different generations. Like, you guys were sort of the folks that we were looking up to and modeling a lot of the way we operate and the way we think about music and what percussion can be, to the masses. But we don't have orchestra in common with the four of us. For the four of us, it was Yale and a really intense chamber music, orchestra was part of our lives, but it wasn't the thing. It wasn't where we all met. And can you talk a little bit about why do you think orchestra, why did the four of you in an orchestra percussion section over time, or five or six of you over time, why was that the gathering place for percussionists and for the four of you in particular? Yeah.
Good question. And it was another world then. Mm-hmm. We're talking 50, 60 years ago.
Right.
It was another world and there were different values in the society. Percussion music was non-existent. John Cage's music, although it had been written 30 years before I was in college, was not unknown. It was virtually unknown. It was mm-hmm. not part of the pedagogy in the conservatories. The only jazz wasn't even in the conservatories at that point. Mm-hmm. There was no at Eastman. There was a jazz program, but it was all extracurricular. The students did it all on their own. It was not part of the formal structure. In fact, a lot of colleges and music schools, when Nexus was in college, a lot of music schools elsewhere didn't even have percussion departments yet. When I went to Philadelphia Orchestra concerts, they didn't, when they needed an extra player, they didn't hire a percussionist. They hired a violinist in the back stand to come back and play the triangle. Mm. They hired a cellist in the back stand to come back and play the castanets and Capriccio Espanol. So they were... The percussion simply was not on the radar screen, except in the symphony orchestras, and even then to a limited extent. There was another world. The percussionists, I mean, even today, when even Nexus, having played with orchestras all over the world, when we go somewhere, we have to sort of justify ourselves. Mm. There's still the old world zeitgeist of percussion being something that anybody can do in the background, and it's just like color. And isn't that cute? But it doesn't take any really technical skill, or you don't really have to even be a musician to do that stuff.
Right. It's like, so why does the percussionist, why are the percussionists playing the horns in American in Paris? Like why did that become a thing? Why doesn't the French horn player play that? It's like,
right. Well, the answer is the French horn players are musicians and the percussionists are not.
Right.
And it wasn't that explicit. It wasn't explicitly put that way, but that was the reality of that world 60 years ago.
But there's a note in Bartok's the two piano two percussion piece, right, or the sonata for two piano two percussion, where he says, like, if the percussionists get off, take care to keep track of them, or something like that.
Absolutely. And you know, that's the Bartok double piano sonata for two pianos and percussion was an incredibly challenging work for percussionists.
Yeah.
Even guys who were working as part of the symphony orchestra, and even timpanists who were considered maybe part of the musical world, but you know, still that over there, it's not part of what we do with our violins and cellos.
Right.
even there, it was extremely difficult for them to keep the time. I remember when I was in high school, we did a concert with Edgar Varese, and he stood behind us during one of the rehearsals of his piece called Offrande, which is for soprano and chamber group. Mm-hmm. And he was coaching the percussionists about how to play quintuples. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, it's not 1-2, 1-2-3. It's not 1-2-3, 1-2. It's 1-2-3-4-5.
Yeah.
1-2-3-4-5. He had to coach the musicians in the orchestra how to play quintuples.
Right.
You know, that just doesn't exist today, because in that world, another culture, another time, another place, the values were different, and the zeitgeist was different. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to understand. This is what's fascinating about the past. We think we know what the past was like, but when you start to dig deeper, you realize the past is another world. It's another place. People have different ways of thinking about things. Mm-hmm. This happens from generation to generation. You will experience the same thing when the kids who have electrodes or silicon chips implanted in their brains and can listen to any music they want just by thinking about it, when they talk to you about what it was like before that. I mean, it's that kind of difference.
Well, we spoke a little bit about that in the car. We were driving back and forth the hotel up at Drum Boogie. The four of us are now sort of – we've been – adopted by an older, we are now the older, on the cusp of being the next.
Congratulations.
thanks. noticing that there's another generation starting to take form and mark out where their values lie, and sort of that negotiation of different generations of where you overlap and how you manage that is really interesting. And I think your point about thinking about the past as this other time, I mean, I often think of if you keep going back and you go back to the like Civil War days of any time there's an army. I mean, percussion comes historically speaking out of a lot of it comes from the military and the thing
in the West.
What? Sorry.
In the West.
In the West, of course. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. Absolutely. Percussion has been around for millennia and cultures, you know, all over the world. But in terms of Western classical music, it evokes a military feeling because the drummer was the person keeping people in step. And in the war, the drummer was the first person you tried to shoot, because if you could shoot him, the people couldn't march and they'd become disorganized, you know. And the drummer would get shot and just the next person in line picked up the drum and kept going. And I often wonder if something far back as that has affected the way like fifth grade band is taught now. Like, is there any part of that that is still tied together as to why is it that percussionists were always the people in the back, always the sort of ragtag folks that, well, basically whoever's left, you know? And in our culture, that's what the drummer originally was the person just keeping everybody together and was the main target of the opposing army.
Well, actually, it was considered ungentlemanly to shoot the other guy's drummer, because usually they were boys. They were right. Kids under the 15, because they couldn't carry the heavy muskets. Mm. So they were delegated as the drummers, but they played a very important role. And it was considered very ungentlemanly to shoot a drummer. But you know, they couldn't aim their guns. Going back to the American Revolution, what they would do is they would fire volleys because they were not accurate. The guns weren't rifled.
Yeah.
So when the bullet came out of the gun, it could be affected by the wind. It could be affected by gravity, by tons of other things, because the bullet wasn't spinning to make it stable as it in its trajectory. So they would all of the soldiers would line in up in a row, point their guns generally in the direction of the enemy, and they'd all fire at once. And if you were charging into that, this volley of shot would come at you. In other words, it wasn't really until the Civil War when the weapons started to be rifled that you could aim at somebody 200 yards away and actually hit them with a bullet. So the Civil War was a big change in all of this, and the drummer's role immediately became that of what I would call stretcher duty. So they would play the drums in camp, not in battle. They wouldn't at the beginning of the Civil War. They marched into battle. It was disastrous. Everybody who marched up against a volley of rifles was killed, including the drummers and everybody else around them. So it was, that's why the numbers of casualties just went through the roof in the Civil War.
And when you say rifle, does that mean the scoring on the inside of the barrel so that the bullet spins like a football?
Absolutely.
That's why a football spiral
stabilizes the bullet in its trajectory.
Yeah.
So, and rifles, there were riflers during the Revolutionary War. They were special soldiers, and there were only very few of them in the armies. Most of them were just using muskets. So you pull the trigger, the ball comes out of the other end, the wind takes it, gravity takes it, and it goes where it goes. And you really don't have much aim beyond about 50 yards. So anyway, the drummers were really important in keeping all of that together, but we're digressing.
Yeah, well, the reason I bring that up a little bit is because you guys also have, like, I feel like another thing that draws you all and Nexus together is, like, the traditional military-style rudimental drumming. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, you sort of mentioned that they drum in camp, and sort of what was the role of the drummer, and how did you guys, what was it about that inspired you all in Nexus to embrace that?
Well, the only real pedagogy before the Saul Goodman timpani book and the Goldenberg xylophone book and mallet keyboard book, the only real pedagogy was snare drum pedagogy, which was standardized during the Civil War. So that was the rudimental system. And when you studied percussion in our day, back in the 1950s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, you studied snare drum. That was the door opener. Today it's marimba. So that's completely changed. It's another world. But in those days it was snare drum. You learn the rudiments. I remember learning to play Three Camps and Downfall of Paris and all those tunes in high school, and then learning to read music and to think about percussion playing through that window and make all the connections, including timpani playing and orchestra playing. All that was built out of the open door of the snare drum to let percussionists get into music in that way, through rhythm and through the rudiments and that pedagogy. Mm-hmm. But then again, as world communication started to improve, as music schools, interest in music schools grew, and as a lot of other factors, but music schools started to adapt percussion departments based largely in the beginning on snare drumming, and then expanding that out into the orchestral world where there was opportunity and where you could get some amount of respect because of the music you were playing. There was no percussion ensemble. I mean, John Cage's music, his ensemble was his guys who couldn't play roles because they weren't percussionists. He was around a quartet of dancers and composers who created the third construction, if you can believe that.
Right.
That's why there are no roles in the third construction, because they couldn't play snare drum roles. They weren't percussion players.
Which is funny, but they could play nines and sevens?
They could play nines and sevens. Unbelievable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But stuck in that world.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until people started talking to each other and until access to this world of this other world, an other way of thinking about music, Cage and Varese and Chavez and all of the composers who were messing around with those ideas, and it took 30 years for their ideas to get out. So I'll tell you a story. When I was teaching in Japan, a kid came in. I think maybe I told you this story. He came in and played a piece that I really like. And I said, it was great. Where did you get it? He said, well, 2 weeks ago I was on YouTube and this piece was premiered in Oslo.
Mm.
All right. So I liked the piece. I Googled the title, came up with the publisher and ordered it. I had it 3 or 4 days later.
Right.
So the piece that didn't exist, had never been performed 2 weeks before in Oslo, was now being played by a student in Japan. That would have taken 30 years in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
Right.
And today happens immediately. So that's the difference.
Well, who was the first – after Cage premiered Third Construction with his group of friends and dancers, when did that piece resurface for you all? Where did you all butt up against it? Who unearthed it?
I think it was discovered by Black Earth Percussion. Which Gary Kvistad, who's now in Nexus, was a part of. His brother Rick, who's with the San Francisco Opera, has been there many years. Mm-hmm. Alan Oddie, who's with Cincinnati Percussion Group, and Michael Udall, who's retired from the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. They had a quartet. I think they brought it to life. And Nexus came at it through a back door. I think Robin got interested in the music of Cage and gave it to Nexus, and we looked at it. We were bamboozled by it. Had mm-hmm. no idea what it was all about at first. Mm-hmm. Learned to love the piece, and we've probably given several hundred performances of it, including for Cage. Mm. And the piece is a masterpiece in that it continues to evolve, continues to display something new and fresh every time you play it.
Yeah.
So those kinds of connections now happen routinely through the internet, through exactly what we're doing right now, talking to each other mm-hmm. in a situation where, in spite of the difficulties we've had making the connection this morning to get this dialogue happening, if you've ever tried to make a phone call from Philadelphia to New York in the 1950s, it was much more complicated yeah. and much less likely to have success. So we live in a world where communication is just part of the world now. And that was much more complex and much more difficult to accomplish 60 years ago.
What were some of the things that Cage, when you all played for him, that's another thing that we feel is our very clear generational sort of demarcations of, like, there's folks who met Cage and worked with him, and there's folks who didn't. And we are, right. He died in 92, I think, and 91 or 92. And we never met him. All we hear is stories. And so our version of Third Construction is not based on anything that, it's not based on any firsthand knowledge of John Cage. It's based on the firsthand knowledge of the four of us and our accumulated experiences. For you all, what did he have to say about the piece? What did he have to say about performing his music? And did you have any, like, did he ever contradict himself in the way that we all talked about him now? Like, is there anything surprising about Cage that folks might be interested to hear?
Well, I think he wrote this in one of his books. I don't know which book. I try not to have prejudgments about things, but I do. Mm-hmm. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Okay. So he never said anything to us about any of the performances we did. We took tempos that were different from what the markings were. We used our own instruments. By the way, we were at a festival in Germany. No, it was in England, mm-hmm. Where Kumada was there, Amadinda was there, a group from Australia was there. Mm-hmm. We all got to play Third Construction in our own way. One of the groups, I don't remember which one, was playing Third Construction, and I didn't even recognize it until about 3 minutes in. Uh-huh. Why? Because they had their concept of the piece, what instruments should be playing, what the tempo should be, how are we gonna work together as an ensemble, how's this part gonna interact. It was completely different. Mm. So there's, in spite of the fact that everything is specifically notated, one of the fascinations about being a percussionist is that you're still making your own sounds. Mm-hmm. Your interpretation of what a tom-tom sound is can be radically different. Your interpretation of what kind of tin cans to use can be radically different. So when we played for Cage, he never really commented about our performances at all, never said anything. Mm. He simply accepted it. So this was one case where he accepted and didn't have a problem accepting.
It's funny. It's one of the things that, I mean, I think as a student growing up, coming through grad school, you sort of, at least as far as I'm, my experience was, like, grad school is that moment when you feel like you're still learning, you're still studying, you're taking advice, but you know enough to be dangerous. So you start yeah. sort of like building your own manifesto of what is okay and what's not okay and what you like about what folks are doing out there and what you don't like. And I remember having very hard and fast rules about certain things. But now that when I joined So, we started getting criticism with the way that we played Third Construction. Like, somebody would come up and say, like, if you're using plastic heads on your tom-toms, you shouldn't be playing Third Construction. You should only use skin drums. You should only use Chinese tack toms. Like, people are very pure. I feel like it's like the way people talk about a Baroque period ensemble. Like, don't play a Baroque period ensemble if you're not going to use a viola da gamba or whatever. And when you look at the score, he just says five graduated Tom Toms. Like, he doesn't say, or three graduated Tom Toms and five graduated tin cans. He's not, he's unspecific enough that it leaves stuff open to interpretation. But what's been interesting to me about Cage is people really do have incredibly strong feelings about the right and the wrong way to play his music. And it's always been confusing to me, that approach to specifically Cage's music.
It's confusing to me too, about any music. It's not a science, and it's an art. And that means that people have a right, in my view, to do what they think is right. And they don't have a right to tell other people what is right. I mean, conductors all the time in symphony orchestra are telling you what Debussy wanted and what Beethoven wanted. I'm sorry, they don't have a clue what those guys wanted. They weren't there, and it's all about ego, and it's about building your fortress around your ideas,
right?
To strengthen your own your ego. I think that's what the bottom line is there musically. Viva la difference. If something moves you to go a certain way, nope. Glenn Gould got creamed for playing Bach the way he played Bach.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it's wonderful to hear Bach played that way.
Right.
Doesn't mean everybody has to play that way. It means that's the way he plays it. And
right.
You know,
right.
Take it or leave it, you know?
Yeah. There's an interesting, do you know the podcast Radio Lab?
Unfortunately, no. Josh,
there's a really, it's a really interesting podcast, and they sort of take interesting, like, urban legends or something that comes up, and they sort of explore it a little deeper. And they took one about Beethoven's tempo markings and how conductors are like, oh, this is the tempo that you play it at, not the one he wrote. And so they look at the Fifth Symphony, and there's a string quartet who is on the podcast, and they start playing it at the original tempo, or the tempo that is most like the performance practice tempo, ba 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 bum, ba 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 bum, ba da 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 dee 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 dee, like the more common approach that we know. And then and they talk about why people are like, oh, his Beethoven's metronome was broken, or it was miscalibrated, all this stuff. And then they take the approach of like, well, what if Beethoven really was not cared about, like, let's take his tempo markings as perhaps more important. Let's put them at the top of the food pyramid in terms of what we think is important. And maybe Beethoven was okay with a few wrong notes and a few wrong rhythms, but what he wanted was incredible energy in his music. And so they then work their way up to the tempo that Beethoven wrote, and it is insane to hear that music that fast. It's like a completely different animal. And then you get the sense, it's like, man, if this guy was losing his hearing, and that life experience coupled with watching an orchestra play his music with just blood, sweat, and tears, like, why is that? Why do we not feel like his tempo is a right note, just like we feel like starting Beethoven Fifth with a rest is a right note? Do you know what I mean?
Sure. Well, you know, it's not a simple question. It's a complex question. Yeah. It has to do with past performance practices, has to do with teachers, has to do with critics, has to do with musicians who've learned the parts and what they expect.
Mm-hmm.
It's really complex. I still say viva la difference. If somebody wants to play Beethoven at half tempo, go for it, because you're going to have an experience that's unique, and you're going to hear things that you would never hear any other way. If somebody wants to play it twice as fast, go for it, because you're going to hear things that you would never hear any other way. And why not? Why not? What's the reason for not doing that?
Yeah.
There is no good. It's about somebody's ego somewhere. There's no good reason to not create an experience. I'll tell you one rehearsal we had with the Philharmonic when I was in it over the years. We were playing Daphnis and Chloe, the suite, and at the end there's this 5-4 movement that's really vigorous. And for the rehearsal purposes, the conductor played the at about 1/3 the tempo.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of yup bup 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 bup, like, it was going yum ba bum ba bum. And I'll tell you, man, it was like being on Mars in one way, and it was like being incredibly open-minded and getting inside the piece and to hear things that you could never hear any other way.
Yeah,
I would love to do that on a concert, but the world wouldn't accept it right now. There's just too many people who think they know what it should be and are unwilling to take the risk of hearing it another way.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think of things as like being high risk or low risk. People very rarely then equate the other side of the equation, high consequence or low consequence. Like, so yeah, exactly. Playing Beethoven Fifth at the tempo that it's written is a high risk exercise. You're going to miss notes. There's rhythms going to get by. You're going to have to stop and restart, possibly. But the consequences of that are incredibly low. Like, yeah. No one's getting physically hurt. Nobody's bank account is being drained because of a stock market crash. Like, you're just hearing something fast or slow. And I feel like, the older I'm getting, the more I am trying to embrace the high risk, low consequence side of music performing. And that brings me a little bit to a question about Nexus now. Like, you all started in a very high risk, low consequence mode of performing, which is improvisation, where you never know what's going to come out of your partner or necessarily what's going to come out of your hands. But again, the consequences are relatively low. It's an act of discovery. Can you talk a little bit about why Nexus dove headfirst into improvisation and how that sort of formulated your sound over years?
Absolutely. I teach improvisation. I taught improvisation at the Eastman School and brought it back into classical. Try to get it back into the classical pedagogy. Mm-hmm. The only reason we improvised was because we were too poor to hire a conductor, commission a composer to write music for this collection of world instruments, and to bring the composer to hear them all, because there was no way that a composer would have any clue about what these things sounded like. So this is all part of this globalization process that started in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. We're collecting instruments. Each one is unique. They have their own tuning systems. They have their own sound qualities. They go together and they blend different ways. There's no way for a composer who has had no experience with any of these instruments to write music for it. I shouldn't say no way. There's very little way. Mm-hmm. But to write music for instruments that they don't understand. So we didn't understand them, and we were playing them. But we were fascinated by the sounds that they were making, and fascinated by the fact that we knew that there were parts of the world where these instruments were very important and part of the musical culture. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know anything about those musical cultures, and were just interested in exploring the sound of the instruments. Mm. So it was simply practical. The only way to play in a concert on these instruments was either to write music ourselves, and we weren't there yet. We eventually got there, but we weren't there yet. Or to simply improvise with it on our own and see what happens. And which we had done many, many times before our first improv concert. We'd improvised amongst ourselves. Mm-hmm. We would tape record the improvisations using a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And then mm-hmm. we listened back to them and critique what we had done. Mm-hmm. Because there was no other way to get a sense of really what was going on in the improvisations. Were they engaging? Were there moments of sheer boredom, or were there moments of sheer passion or whatever? Mm-hmm. And so we would analyze them, and we found them to be hilarious and fascinating. So we wanted to give that to an audience, and we tried to see if that would happen. We did our first concert as although Bob and I had experimented in a couple of coffee shops here in Rochester, our first formal concert was at the Eastman School with John Robin, Bob Becker, and myself. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea what was going to happen. We set all of our stuff up on Kilburn Hall stage. And all we did for 2 hours was wander around the stage and improvise. And the review the next morning was absolutely fabulous. And we felt good about what we had done, although we didn't really understand it. Mm-hmm. Let's do this again. Mm-hmm. So we did it again in a couple of months at the University of Toronto. And then okay, this is good. Let's do it again. We did a whole summer of it. At Niagara-on-the-Lake during the Shaw Festival 1 year. So it gradually expanded. And then we started to discover that we were thinking a little differently about our orchestra parts when we go back to our gigs, that we were hearing more, that we were experimenting more and able to connect what we were thinking about the music in our little parts on the snare drum and triangle and bass drum and make them more satisfying to us to be a part of the orchestra. So there were all kinds of benefits that came out of these improvisational experiences that we were able to transfer to other forms of music making in a very positive way. And that's why continue to be interested in that. In fact, we Nexus just played a concert 2 weeks ago where it was our 50th anniversary concert in Kilburn Hall with a couple of guest performers, Michael Burt, John Beck, people associated with Eastman, where we did a group improvisation concert for 1 hour, and it was fantastic. It's recorded. We'll get it up on YouTube at some point. So we're still very interested in that. And the course I taught at Eastman was not just for percussionists. It was for mixed instrumentation. I've done improv workshops for symphony orchestras. Now, this is great. You take an Amadinda into a symphony orchestra, and you get a violinist who is a great musician, can play absolutely anything on the violin, and they don't want to improvise on the violin because they're afraid of doing something that's not right. So you put them on an Amadinda, and they freak out because they're great musicians. They know musical phrasing. They know musical ideas. It comes out naturally. And once they realize that it's not rocket science and that they have something to say, they can go back to their instruments and say something on the spot because they have all of this technique, all of this experience. And it's a big part of their musicianship that is not fully understood or exploited and put into use. So I'm a real advocate today. I'm going to be going to Cleveland Institute next week, actually a week from yesterday, to do some improvisation workshops with the percussion department there. Although I would have preferred that it be open to all of the departments because you really learn about other instruments. And, you know, in the improvisation, everything is part of the experience. There are no mistakes. If something comes out that you didn't want to happen, you learn from it. It's part of the what happens. It's like the real world. Things happen in the world. And things are not necessarily connected until you look at them in hindsight. So there's a very deep philosophical idea about improvisation, and we're improvising right now, you and I. But it's a part of our lives. We do it every day. It's, in fact, it's the biggest part of our lives. We're making something happen based on our limited experience and trying to make something positive happen.
I know one of the things for me that's always been a barrier when I improvise is I'm struck immediately how much I am actually bilingual in some respects. I speak English, but I also speak conventional Western music notation.
Absolutely. So,
and I happen to speak a very specific type of that notation on like the steel drums, for example, or the marimba, things I know my way around. But as soon as I have to, if I have to pick up like an oboe or something, I don't know the techniques on the oboe. I don't know the way. It's like picking up a different, like going to, you know, parts of Louisiana and all of a sudden having to understand Creole or something. Like, what? I don't speak this language. I know they're speaking a language that I should understand, but the slang is completely different, you know? So in music, it's like, you know, a language, but not quite well enough to know the slang. So you immediately resort to speaking in very simple, slow, like, you know, if you're, when you're speaking to international audiences, like if you're in, you know, we were just in Lithuania last week, your instinct when you get on stage is not to talk like we're talking now. You start to talk very slowly and you think long and hard. You're not improvising anymore. You're regurgitating a script because you want it to be as clear as possible to folks who don't understand you. But that, it always feels clunky. It always feels awkward. And it's just because I don't have practice at it. And I, when I think about improv, I just, I'm always reminded, like, damn it, I should do this more because it's not, it's just a different language I'm not very familiar with.
Well, I think it would be really interesting in music schools to have at least a mini course where musicians get together in a room and they have to create music on an instrument that they've never played before. So the whole ensemble is experimenting and discovering and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And I think that would be extremely fascinating to hear what happens and to listen to the playback of the recording of this piece created by musicians who have access to the language but don't know the vocabulary. So and they're creating their own vocabulary. Nexus has done some concerts where one of us will play a trumpet or one of us will play an instrument that – a string instrument that we've never used before just to see what happens. And it not only opens doors that would never have otherwise been opened, but it leads to beautiful things that otherwise would never have happened. So,
well, one of the things, I mean, we talked a little bit, and you mentioned the music from other cultures, and especially being a percussionist, that almost all of our instruments come from, you know, it's other places, and there's some amalgamation of, you know, hybrid versions of, you know, a drum set is a series of different drums from all over the place that you put together and you hit to make one composite instrument. How have you all approached embracing other cultures' instruments? The word of cultural appropriation is getting thrown around a lot these days. Right. And it's been thrown at me because I'm a white guy who plays steel drums and teaches steel drums. But my approach has always been one of, trying to pay back and be as respectful as I can of where the music comes from, and to travel to these places and meet people from the cultures just to sort of have a little more context. But I never felt ashamed playing a steel drum or that I shouldn't be doing it.
Or should you ever, you know?
I personally feel that. But how have you all embraced that, and what are your thoughts around the way people are talking about this stuff now?
Yeah. Good question. We don't give any thought to it. If we like something and we want to play on it, it's our right. And so it's our right, as it is every civilization's right, to learn from another civilization. Mm-hmm. It's been going on through history. Everything in the percussion world, in fact, everything in the orchestral world, all the instruments come from other cultures.
Yeah.
They all come from the Middle East or India or China. Cultural appropriation is inevitable. There can't be any other system. People are going to be exposed to ideas from other places in the world, and that's only going to accelerate with today's globalization through the internet and other things. Mm-hmm. Ideas are going to you can't build a wall around an idea. Yeah. And so that's what people are trying to do. This is my idea. You can't have a part of it. That's completely irrational and irrelevant to have an idea like that. People are going to communicate, and people are going to be inspired by what they hear from other people.
Yeah.
And part of being human. And I'm all in favor of it, frankly. You've got Indian musicians playing on electronic keyboards in India. You've got Chinese musicians playing on Western evolved instruments. You've got, you know, I got Paul Simon going to South Africa you know, exploring that music, and it's just nature's way, and it's happening all over the world. And viva the difference, and go for it.
Yeah, I've always had. I feel like the word cultural appropriation. In my head, I've always instead of appropriation, I've thought of thievery. I mean, there is definitely a way to steal, and to, you know, to co-opt and to make money off of somebody else's idea without crediting them properly. But right. And I always feel like I'm trying to be very aware of that when I'm doing anything. It doesn't matter if it's just music. If my gut tells me that I should be thanking someone for what I'm doing, then I try to do it. Yeah. If my gut tells me that I'm doing this because I love it, and, you know, I genuinely think this is a beautiful part of another culture, I'm going to try to embrace it and be as honest about where this came from. Who I learned about it from, but the moment I feel like I'm sort of venturing into the territory of thievery or stealing something, then I feel like, you know, that's where you need to back off. And I know of instances where people have stolen before, whether it be, you know, recorded music that's then transcribed and sold later. That happens a lot. That to me is appropriation. But just using another instrument from another culture because you think it's awesome, that to me feels a little tricky to start to go down that road, because it's like everything in life has some version of that.
Well, you know, we play on African drums in Nexus. We always have. Mm-hmm. We play music that we identify as inspired by the music of Africa, right. Even though we learn from African musicians and learn the compositions. We are not African, so we're not going to play it the way an African musician would play it, although I believe an African musician would understand what we're doing. Mm-hmm. and make the connection and know that it's inspired by their music. But you can't stop people from communicating and from learning to others. And copyright area is really dicey.
Yeah.
In the West, we have laws about this, copyright laws, which can protect to a certain point. So the problem with the rest of the world is some of them don't have very funky copyright laws or don't have them.
Right.
And plus, the music has been around so long that it's not really copyrightable anyway.
Yeah.
It's part of the world. And so I just don't have a problem with it as long as you don't misidentify it. We don't play African music. We play music inspired by the music of Africa.
Right, right.
Simple. And, right. and that's telling the truth.
Yeah, I agree. Well, in your time with Nexus, what would you say was one of the – like if you could – like when you're on your deathbed and you're like running through all your memories of your concerts with Nexus – or we could even zoom out a little bit, just your life as a musician. What would you say is a highlight or two that you're like, man, yeah, that was good.
Well, Carnegie Hall with the Boston Symphony premiering to Takemitsu's From Me Flows What You Call Time was a real highlight. Mm-hmm. And then reprising that premiere in Japan was also part of that. So I'd put them both together. Because of a lot of things, our orchestral experiences in our background, our association with the Takemitsu, Toro Takemitsu for many decades, having the opportunity to do that in Carnegie Hall, that we've played in Carnegie Hall and all of us in a number of other occasions for other things, non-Nexus events. That was really a highlight, and that was a peak to bring everything together. For us in our careers at that point. That was in 1990, October of 1990. So that would be one of the highlights. But the other thing is, you know, having a career in music, I can't imagine anything that would have been more fulfilling. Mm-hmm. You wake up in the morning, yeah, I'm going to spend 5 hours today with some of the great minds of Western civilization. I'm going to spend 5 hours today exploring these instruments that are in my basement. I have no idea where it's going to go. It's mm-hmm. going to be exciting. No, I'm going to spend 3 hours today for an audience halfway around the world that doesn't have a clue what we're doing.
Yeah.
I'm going to inspire them in some way. I can't imagine anything better than that. And everyone should have a passion like that deep, and the world would be a much better place for whatever they do. It doesn't. You don't have to be passionate about music. You can be passionate about gardening or about putting pieces of machinery together to make something that's really quality product. The passion is a good thing, and artists are the door openers to the world of passion. And so it's a good thing. I wouldn't change it.
Well, what's something that people? I mean, I always get. You know, either students or, you know, family members or who are always like, man, it must be a dream to work with three of your best friends and like to be able to play music with your friends. That's the dream. And I don't disagree with them, but the thing that nobody really ever wants to talk about is the complexities of working with your friends, you know, running a business, playing music with your friends. What are some things that people never told you about being in a percussion group like this full, you know, for a living that you wish you had some heads up about?
Well, the heads up wouldn't have helped, I don't think, because you got to go through it.
Yeah.
And it's like being married. You have to reinvent the marriage continually because people change, attitudes change, the world around you changes, change happens. You have to recreate. And if you have that mentality that, okay, it's not 60 years ago, it's today. The world is different. I'm different. People around me are different. Today is another day. It's never happened before. It's never going to happen again. I've got to be in today and make every day valuable and unique, no matter whether it's music or anything else. That's the right attitude, I think. And that's really the only healthy attitude to have.
Yeah. Well, the one of the things that before Robin Englund passed away, we did a show in Toronto, and we had some time to hang at his apartment with him and his wife, and Robin was telling some hilarious stories. But then as I'm sure you are aware, Robin could do quite vividly. But then he pulled out a book. I think it was titled Yorkers. Does that?
Oh yeah,
and sure. he loaned it to me for a while, and I, you know, I took it home. It was this really beautiful bound, like individually typed up.
Made those books.
Yeah, I know. That's what he said. That's why I wanted to ask you about it. What was that? And it really struck me as this is why I'm asking this after the question I just asked. Is like, yes, you're 4, 5, 6 friends in vans all the time. You're constantly, you're improvising, you're butting heads, you're arguing about money, you're shooting the shit over beers at the bar afterwards. All of that stuff happens. And it felt to me like that was a really beautiful sort of like, hey, no matter what happens, here's some of the gems that we've polished over the years. And they were just like little one sentence, two sentence phrases that sort of really summarized. It felt to me like little moments in your career together. Can you talk a little bit about that little binding?
I'm sorry, Josh.
No, just can you talk a little bit about why you made that and what it was about?
Well, this was at a 2-week seminar workshop / concert residency at York University in Toronto. That's why it's called Yorkers. Mm. And these are just comments that all you have to do is have a paper, a piece of paper and a pencil and listen. And these things happen all day long, all the time, everywhere in your life. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is note them. If somebody says something that strikes you, that's interesting, just write it down. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. And it turns out that they're very deep. You know, these little things that you ignore during the day are the real deal. That's where the action is. So you have to pay attention. John Wire always used to say, the first thing I learned when I was in elementary school, John Wire, was stop, look, listen. Did you ever have that in school? It had to do with crossing the street.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, listen. He said that works all the time. Stop, look, listen. And I would add, right,
Yeah. You notice speak was not in there.
Exactly.
Open your mouth and tell people what you think is not always the option that you want.
No, oh, but it happens.
Yeah. Well, it's a really, I wish you, is it published? Like, it's not published for public consumption, is it?
I'm going to take it to PASIC and see what happens and see if people are, it's really for friends. And it's exactly what I was just saying. It's just writing down things that strike as particularly important. And in this case with the book, expanding that and thinking about what that means, what the meaning is for me personally, and maybe for the world around my activities, what is the meaning of all of this? We're all looking for that anyway.
Well, I think if people are at PASIC and they come across this book, they should definitely get it or peruse it because, it's really quite striking and it's really beautifully done. I mean, it's like, did you do it all on a typewriter, all the individual versions?
No, most of it is from the blog. I been blogging for now about 20 years, all of the stuff was just taken off the blog.
Okay.
and then given a current tweak to make it more in line with my thinking today than 20 years ago. But these are just all notes that I've been taking. There's a lot more, and I had to whittle it down to things that I thought were more relevant than others. So it's just been going on for years.
Well, before we wrap up here in a little bit, I have a few more questions, if that's okay.
Go for it.
You also, I feel like what makes you unique out of the other guys in Nexus is you really have, maybe Gary does this to an extent, but I feel like you really do a very detailed job of curating weird percussion instruments, whether it be like the wind machine, which is like this huge, it looks like the thing that they turn to like in Bingo where all the balls bounce around and then there's a big piece of canvas wrapped over top. And like, you'll do a deep dive on that or another weird, calliope machine, something like that in the percussion world. And I feel like you've had an interest in stuff like that and documenting it and writing about it. And can you talk about a little bit why that is, where that comes from and what your reasons or mission is behind that sort of conserving of old, interesting oddities in the percussion world?
Well, it's just a general interest in sound and what are the possibilities. For example, when the Eastman Theater organ was demolished, it was an accompaniment organ for the silent films in the Eastman Theater. Literally, organ pipes were being thrown out of the third floor rooms where the organ was located and thrown into a dumpster. Uh-huh. And I went fishing through the dumpster and fished out about a dozen or so organ pipes that were between 6 inches and 12 inches long, mm-hmm. thinking, what can I do with these things? So I built a thing called a twirly tone, where the pipes are stood upright, rotating in a circle over a hole, an open hole over which, into which I inserted a rubber tube so I could blow through the hole. Mm-hmm. The organ pipes would rotate around one by one over that hole mm-hmm. as they rotated in a circle, and you would get the sound of a bird call. Mm. And I used that in – I think a photo of that is posted on the Nexus website. It's called a twirly tone, I call it. Mm-hmm. But you can maybe find it there. And that's used in a composition called The Birds, looking for a way to get a bird sound that's in like a vireo kind of, which is really fantastic, that you can't get any other way, really. Maybe you can get it with a keyboard if you screw around with an electronic keyboard and get good samples. Mm. So it's just a matter of experimenting, and these thoughts come into your head. Who knows where they come from? What if I do this? What if I do that? What does that do? And it's just playfulness, basically.
Well, what are some highlights of your collection that what are some of your favorites?
Well, I built a tunable bass drum using cable mechanisms from Dresden Timpani, uh-huh. so that you could actually have a bass drum that's in tune with a symphony orchestra. So, for example, with a Tchaikovsky Fourth, I could tune an F on the bass drum. It does not sound like a timpani; it sounds right. like a bass drum, but it's an F. And it supports the orchestra, and people turn around and look, what's going on with that bass drum? Because they hear something that they've never heard before,
right?
And they don't know what it is. And until you tell them, they're totally fascinated by it. Mm. So I did this for the bass drum solos in the Verdi Requiem, huge bass drum solos, tune the bass drum to a G, and that had the same effect, really something special about that sound. So I did it for La Valse. I took the bass part, contrabass part, and wrote the tunings for every bass drum note in. And for example, boom dun da da da, boom dun da da da, boom dun da da da, boom. All right. Mm-hmm. So I was changing the pitch of the bass drum for every one of those notes.
You shut your mouth, Bill Kahn. Did you really do that?
I really did that, because
that's amazing.
Well, this comes back to what we were saying earlier about what's expected and what's not expected, and what's right and what's wrong, and who's going to say that. All right. So what happened in the rehearsal, first rehearsal of that, I remember Zinman was conducting. About 10 bars into that phrase, he stopped, looked back, and winced in my direction. And then the whole violin section turned around and looked back. Mm-hmm. And I realized it might have been a bit much. So the sun came up the next morning. We all had a good laugh. He Zinman, and of course my friends in the orchestra were all forgiving. Mm-hmm. And we went back to a single note or two. I did still make some changes, but I didn't push the envelope like that. So it's a learning lesson. Right. It worked in one case. It works in the Mahler. It works in the Mahler Symphony 2, Mahler 3rd, tuned to an A. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But it worked in some cases. It's great. In other cases, it's too much. It's over the top. It's not right. And nor should it be done.
Don't underthink your tunable bass drum, but don't overthink it either.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I had a friend in grad school who passed away a few years ago, but he used to, no matter what timpani note he was playing, he would always, if he could, tune the octave lower and lightly feather it. And he talked about it like he was like, it was inspired by this timpani. I don't remember who his teacher was, but his teacher always talked about timpani as an organ note, as a low organ note. And if you think of those low, like the low pedal C, when you stand next to a low pedal C on an organ, you don't hear a C, you hear the beating, yeah. Right? But when you pair it with the octave above it, you all of a sudden hear a really full C. Because
absolutely.
They're related relationally, or a ratio. They're ratially. I'm not even saying that correct. They're related, and so on a bass drum, it's like you're not, like you said, you're going to hit that bass drum, and it's going to be such a slow beating pattern that you won't necessarily perceive it as an F or a G. But when paired with an entire orchestra that's playing an F, you know, you sense
and,
it.
You know, the same thing was I got into using tuned triangles so that the pitch of the triangle was in the key of the orchestra. I got into using cymbals that were tuned. You know, every cymbal is not a pitchless instrument. Every cymbal has a pitch, a fundamental pitch, and that can be used, believe it or not, and it's noticeable. People don't necessarily know what they're hearing, but they notice something when you do that. So this is where creativity comes in. Even in a repertoire that's 200 years old, the people have been playing, well, don't you get tired of playing that? No, you can do it another way. Yeah. Let's see what happens, you know? These are the things that came back from this improvisatory experience, coming back to roost in another turf, you know? So it's all connected that way.
Well, as you, what would you say? This is just something that I'm curious about because students are always afraid to admit when they have a weakness on something. They're more apt to say what they're good at, and not so apt to say what they're bad at. What would you say now that you're? How old are you? If you don't mind me asking,
72. I'll be 73 in a month.
So now that you're 70, you're going to be 73. What would you say now? Are you willing to cop to in terms of what are your strengths and what are some of the things that are your biggest weaknesses when you're in the room with your colleagues in Nexus where there's no judgment, there's no, you know, everybody's got different strengths and weaknesses, but you're amongst your comfort zone of friends. What are the things you're willing to admit to and the things you're good at and you're bad at?
Keyboards have always been a struggle for me. Because I didn't enter into the percussion through the marimba, or that was a very late coming thing. Playing mallet licks, playing the orchestral excerpts, that all came in college, not in third grade with the snare drum and the bass drum, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a different world. Those who start on keyboard instruments early have a real advantage in today's world because that's part of the zeitgeist. So I struggle with every mallet part. I usually get there, not always. Usually get it to where it needs to be. I know where it needs to be, and there's such great mallet players out there that they're setting the bar very high. Four mallet parts are a struggle for me. I never really studied piano. I've got to really work hard to do that.
Yeah.
And it's not my strength. So if I can play a part that's to my strength, I would prefer to do that, but that's not always possible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and make it work. So I use my own technique. I discover or create a technique to make something work. For example, I think of one chromatic Glockenspiel part that I could never play, even after practicing for several weeks. Mm-hmm. And I solved it in about 2 minutes, realizing that there were some passages that didn't have repeated notes. So what I would do is just string the notes, take them off the Glockenspiel, and rehang them in order. So I just played a scale, and yet I was playing the passage. It was absolutely right. I got it right the first time. I didn't spend 3 months practicing, and I had no qualms about doing that kind of thing.
Yep.
Make it sound right. You do what you have to do and bite your ego. Let that out of the way. The thing is to get it done right, that you can go to sleep at night and say, yeah, I played that part the way it should be played. Not with the technique that everybody else wants me to use, but what should happen for that part.
All
the time.
I have two instances where I've done that. One, I've never done it because I didn't have the guts to do it, but I took an orchestra audition when I was in college, my undergrad. And the first excerpt on the audition I had to play was Porgy and Bess. And I think in the future, if I were ever practicing that piece, or if I were playing it live, I would just move the B natural at the very bottom. I would just pick up the strings and move it down one. So there was no way I could ever, or I'd put a towel over it or something.
Why not? In
the audition, I smacked that B natural, and the conductor was like, "Thank you, next." And I moved, and I didn't get to play the rest of the stuff that I had, you know. And I was like, "Well, if I just didn't even have the option to hit that B natural, it's like, yeah, sure, I could get better at the xylophone, but like, life's too short. Yep. Why don't I figure out another way?" And in drumming, I move the F sharp on the marimba. I just move it down. Like, you don't ever have to play it, and so I have no option but to hit the G sharp.
That's a great strategy in my view.
For me too. And the guys in So make fun of me all the time. I'm like, listen, if you hit that F sharp playing boogie-dum, boogie-dum-dum 3,000 times in a row and you hit that F sharp once, it really sticks out. So I'm going to move it down if I can.
I've done it for that Glock section too. I've moved notes out of the way. If the note doesn't sound, why is it there? You know, get it out of the way so that doesn't, then there's zero risk of you hitting that note.
Right. Right?
And well, so here's the thing though, you got to have tenure first.
That's true. And so they can't kick me out anymore. So I can do those. I can make those sorts of things. Well, what are some things that you bring to the table in Nexus that no one else does? What are your strengths that you feel like you bring to the table?
Well, it's really hard to come up with that because I'm just so used to doing what works and knowing the guys. I think to be forgiving to others and to I don't have expectations of other players. Mm. I just have expectations for myself, and I rarely meet all of them, and I'm comfortable with that. I found a way to live with myself. This is surprising. I think a lot of artists have a lot of self-doubt about what they do. I think it's natural, and you find a way to live with it and to get over it and to do what you got to do anyway. And so I think the four of us have worked that out over 50 years. And I guess that's a strength, is accepting, learning how to accept yourself and trust it.
I would say that is certainly a strength. Well, before I let you go, Bill, you handed me a book before we parted ways in Woodstock this summer. And I'm curious, can you tell people a little bit about some of your writing that you've been consolidating and editing into this book that you have coming out, and talk a little bit about what the book's about and where you might be able to pick it up?
Oh, well, this is just a book about memoirs, basically. It's called Unpopular Music, and it's a collection of essays and memoirs that have been written over the last, I would say, 30, 40 years of Nexus. But it's not entirely about Nexus. It's about some experiences I've had with conductors, you know, when I was playing in the Rochester Philharmonic, experiences that with food, eating at Charlie Trotter's in Chicago, which was a very, very memorable experience and once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing for me. Mm-hmm. I don't do that kind of thing a lot. Experiences in seeing a dozen Rembrandt self-portraits at museums in Europe over the course of a three-month tour of Nexus throughout Europe and the world. And then at the end, there's a whole section which lists, to the best of my ability, every Nexus concert from the very beginning until 3 weeks ago. So,
does it list what you played on the concert?
The repertoire is there, and the date and the musicians that we played with and the orchestras that we played with. There's several dozen orchestras in that, maybe as many as 70 or 80 orchestras in that list. There are venues all over the world. There are festivals all over the world in that list. And that's just to put a perspective on it. I think the list is maybe 40, 50 pages long in that book of performances from 1968 through to 2019. So, and that was a labor of love. It took a year to put this book together, even drawing out my old blog posts and then sort of tweaking them to make them look through my current eyes instead of my eyes of 20 years ago when I felt that necessary. Mm. So it's about just living in a world of music, and not necessarily percussion specific, although there are a couple of little things in there. It's really about music, and it's not really about percussion, but there it's through a percussionist's eyes. So I guess that's relevant. Anyway, if there's interest in it, I may go through another printing of it. I've printed only 50 copies of this, which I'm giving to friends, and I'm getting feedback from people already. And generally it's pretty good feedback. You know, it's in the big world, it's a very little thing, but it's a very personal thing, and it's what I've got. So I think that it ought to be of interest to other musicians. I hope it is.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, it seems it's an incredible resource if you want to know nothing else other than just to know what rep you all have played and sort of your journey. But in addition to that, the sort of anecdotal stories, all of that stuff in there, just to somebody like me, I'm way more fascinated by like the arguments you may have all had over beer at a restaurant after a show than sort of what you did on the show. For me, those sorts of stories are really tell more about who you guys are and who you are than what the show in particular did. So I hope people check that out. Where can people find your blog?
Go to nexuspercussion.com. You'll see all of the members of the group. You click on Bill Kahn, and then you click on Bill's blog, and you'll have several, maybe, 10 or 15 pages worth of blog postings from dating back probably to internet activity early 2000s, maybe even going into the 1990s. Mm. There might be some blog posts from the 1990s there. So that's already, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. You were on blogs before people knew what blogs were. Blogging became a big thing in the early 2000s, but the idea that you were doing that in the 90s is pretty progressive. You were out on the tip of the spear.
Well, again, it's about noticing, stop, look, listen, and then write. And that's been a part of it all through the years. So that's what this is.
Well, one final question, then I'll let you go. You all have been, like I said in the beginning, our standard bearers for the idea that percussion could hold a stage by itself for an entire evening for audiences. And you know, there's been several moments where it's felt like you've really embraced not just so percussion, but it has felt like we have been part of your club ever since we met you all. And it's just been an honor to share the stage with you the several times that we have. But what are your wishes now at 72? Where do you see this all going? Do you have any wishes or hopes for where it's all going? Or are you happy with where it's headed and just open to see what comes?
Well, my observation today is that music as art form, in other words, art music, is downsizing all over the world. It's being split up. A perfect example is when the University of Michigan School of Music becomes the university, changes its name to the University of Michigan School of Theater, Dance, Performing Arts, and Music. Mm-hmm. All right, so music as an art form, which I totally relate to the radio age into which I was born, yeah, an oral world. That is disappearing into the visual world and now the technical world of devices and thought control through fake news and other devices.
Yeah.
That's the world we're heading into. I don't particularly feel good about where that's going. I fear for the next generations, for what they're facing. They're going to have to struggle awful hard to deal with it and not have its effects be negative on their lives. Mm-hmm. But it's a serious change in the world today, and I worry about that. In terms of art music, to explore the world through the world of sound, it will always be there in one form or another. What form it will take, who knows? Things are changing so fast today. But it won't be what it was. Mm-hmm. And it's disappearing everywhere. I'm sad about that. But on the other hand, change happens, and that's where the world's going right now. And the thing is to be aware of it and to find a way, and it's going to be a personalized way for everyone, mm-hmm, find a way to deal with it and be positive and to be helpful to other people. So it's going to be difficult. But on that sad note, I hate to end on that sad note, but that's what I'm seeing going on.
No, I think I understand the tinge of sadness that's in there, but I think it's sage advice to also to think of what you said, think positively and help each other. I think whether you're thinking about politics or you're thinking about, you know, like you said, gardening or accounting or music or whatever it is you're doing, trying your best to see other people's intentions as good as a sort of baseline, and to see other people's, to sort of, help other people out. I think that's it's a really great way to end that on, Bill. And I really appreciate your time. And I'm sure this won't be the last time we speak. At least I deeply, deeply hope so.
This is a two-way street. So we're learning about each other. And that's it's a great thing. And I totally appreciate your, first of all, your interest in anything that I have to say. But secondly, your very probing questions, which are all right on the mark, I think, and are going right to the essence of the things that I've been thinking about. So I totally appreciate that. And we share a common commonality in our lives, our devotion to music, and in a certain way to the pathway we've chosen through brush instruments and ensembles and so forth. So we share a lot. Probably you and I share more than many other two people would do in the world if you had chosen at random, you know. So it's a good thing. Thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome, Bill. And I always cherish the time we have on stage and backstage together. And I will really, really look forward to the next time. And we can do this in person. And I will try to figure out this video thing. So hopefully the next time we don't have the same problems we had in the beginning. But Bill, thank you so much. Tell Ruth I said hello and best to you. And we will be in touch soon.
Hi to the guys. And let me know when this is going to get out there in some way. I'll try to direct people to come to this direction.
Sounds good. I absolutely will.
Okay.
All right. Thanks,
Bill. All right.
Take care. You too. Bye. Okay. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Bill. I certainly did, and I hope to do it many more times. Bill is always one of the guys after so shows or rehearsals that we have with Nexus that I end up sitting down and sort of chewing the fat with. He's one of the trailblazers for what it is that I do every day. So Bill, thanks. And I'll keep this short. This is Nexus performing John Cage's Third Construction. Enjoy. Talk to you soon. Bye.